And so having these belt buckles, I think to a certain extent, again, played a dual role. On the one hand, it was a way to reinforce the persona of those above them as having this ultimate authority and therefore needing to be obeyed because they were perceived as being gods on earth. But it also, I think, was a way of trying to, I guess to a certain extent, ease the concerns that individual members might have at being forced to do some of the things they were told to do, because they are the people who are, so to speak, on the ground doing the things. They are the people who are looking at the prisoners and interacting with the prisoners every day. They are the people who are being ordered to shoot people at point blank range, oftentimes, who are not armed, who are just innocent civilians, who are there now being asked to kill. And so for these individuals, by giving them belt buckles or by giving them insignia that indicates that they are somehow, that somehow they are approved by God or whatever deities you may or may not believe in, that somehow what they were doing was okay and was justified and would make them less likely to balk at the idea of having to do these things.
Welcome to Activist MMT, a podcast about real-world economics, including modern money theory, and how life changes when you discover it. I'm your host, Jeff Epstein. Today's the final part of a three-part conversation with historian, author, and Harvard master's graduate Emily Rule on her new paper and master's thesis, In League with the Divine, How Religion Influenced Nazi Perpetrators of the Holocaust. You will find my detailed question list at the bottom of the show notes for part one, and also be sure to see the list of audio chapters in all three parts to find exactly where each topic is discussed. A full introduction can be found at the beginning of part one. But for now, let's get right back to my conversation with Emily Rule. Enjoy.
The soldiers, these symbols, these physical symbols, were like, you know, the doctors wore the coats, the commandants sometimes wore the coats, whatever. But the soldiers had the belt buckles, mm-hmm. you know, and it's just kind of, and the pin, I guess, pins and whatever. But like the belt buckles, like these symbols were like were given to them or with them in some way.
Yeah. And it's really, I think you hit the nail on the head there with saying that they were given to them. You really have, if you envision like these doctors and these commandants who have the authority over who's living, who's dying, and even within that context, how people are going to die or how they in turn, how they are going to live. If they're going to be, you know, for instance, if they're going to be experimented on in the case of Mengele and Auschwitz. So you have these people who have this authority and they have this control and in some cases are involved in the killing process because you do have people who are experimented on who do die from the experimentation. So Mengele is responsible directly for the deaths of some of these people. So in some cases, they are directly involved. They have almost this divine status. So I talked a little bit about how doctors felt they had omnipotence, commandants felt they had executive authority, and so they almost take on the persona of gods on earth, in essence, that they are these individuals with divine status with control over everything that's happening in their territory, including life and death. And then you have And in many cases, that is self-fashioned. So you have people like Ebrel who are choosing to wear their coats. They don't have to. They are making that decision. And then you have Stengel, who is creating his own white uniform. So they're creating things to give themselves this physical persona that matches the way that they are assumably seeing themselves. But then you do have the kind of rank and file members, the guards and the individual SS members who have these insignia, the belt buckles, these other parts of their apparel that are given to them, that are assigned to them, that the belt buckle saying that God was with them, that was an assigned part of the uniform. That was not a choice that they had to wear. They had to wear that. And so having these belt buckles, I think to a certain extent, again, played a dual role. On the one hand, it was a way to reinforce the persona of those above them as having this ultimate authority and therefore needing to be obeyed because they were perceived as being gods on earth. But it also, I think, was a way of trying to, I guess to a certain extent, ease the concerns that individual members might have at being forced to do some of the things they were told to do, because they are the people who are, so to speak, on the ground doing the things. They are the people who are looking at the prisoners and interacting with the prisoners every day. They are the people who are being ordered to shoot people at point blank range, oftentimes, who are not armed, who are just innocent civilians, who are there now being asked to kill. And so for these individuals, by giving them belt buckles or by giving them insignia that indicates that they are somehow, that somehow they are approved by God or whatever deities you may or may not believe in, that somehow what they were doing was okay and was justified and would make them less likely to balk at the idea of having to do these things. So I think it definitely served a dual role.
It is an expression of their power, meaning the people who created those symbols and said that you have to have these as part of your uniform. It is an expression of their power. And actually, I am reminded, as you can relate, that every morning when you go to work, there is a flag and you have to pledge to that flag allegiance to the country, which is an expression of the power of the country, of the government, of the state. And so those symbols are, number one, an expression of the coercion, and also a reminder that of the excuse, once you do what we tell you to do, the salve.
Yes. So,
okay. All right, in a footnote on page 75, on a footnote on page 26, the footnote 75, there's someone named Albert Speer who said that he found Hitler to be deeply, quote, deeply exciting, because what he said was the intermingling of frenzy and rationality with which he spoke. Mm-hmm. And in the footnote, it says that he listened to Hitler's, because he listened to Hitler's speeches, that's what convinced him to commit himself to the party. But that speech was not just Hitler speaking. I can only assume that was not just Hitler speaking. It was an audience acting crazily in response to that speech. So he wasn't just listening to Hitler. He was listening to Hitler and the crazed reaction to Hitler. And I'm really reminded of the Beatles, of the screaming crowds of their audiences when they play. You don't just listen to the Beatles. Like, when they go on the Ed Sullivan and whatever, there's not just them on stage. It is the screaming women in the audience. You can't separate those two things. So what was he attracted to? Was he attracted to just Hitler's speeches, or was he attracted to, the reaction to him and caught up in that reaction and manipulated by that reaction? So there's a concept that you bring up called charismatization. So that Hitler as an individual was charismatic, but there was much more than just the individual being charismatic, and that this charismatization was a major part of how the populace was manipulated and propagandized.
Yeah. So Charismatization is actually a coin that is really termed again by, oh goodness, why am I forgetting her? Ruth Wodak. There we go. Ruth Wodak in her The Politics of Fear. And there's this discussion of charisma and the importance of charisma in right-wing political leaders. And the idea of charisma in a political context can really be considered the result of a combination of internal personality traits and external factors. And of these, it's really crucial to note two. So the first is that in terms of internal qualities, right-wing leaders tend to possess a belief that they are a savior of the people, which we see very clearly with Hitler. He himself, even if he never denotes himself as a savior, he feels that he actually does state openly that he thinks he is a prophet who has been basically sent by the gods to do their will. And the second thing is that externally, there is a process of charismatization that happens. This idea that whether it is the party, whether it is the government or the existing regime or some other group, that there is some sort of deliberate attempt to create a religious-like aura around their leader. And again, we also see that very, very clearly. We can see it in Leni Riefenstahl's Triumph of the Wills.
I was just thinking that, the plane coming out of the clouds, right?
Yes. It opens, you know, Germany is very overcast, and it opens with Hitler descending in a plane from the clouds, and then all of a sudden Germany is sunny and beautiful, and the crowds, you know, cheer him, and just like he, again, as Hitler thought that he had been sent by the gods to kind of fix Germany's problems. So that's a very visual representation of it. You have Der Hoheitsträger, which is a popular magazine in Germany at the time that is including articles that are telling people not only what an ideal Nazi home should look like, but one of the things that they specify is that instead of having, you know, Jewish Talmudic sayings on your walls, you should instead, or other religious things on your walls, you should have the Führer's words on your walls. And so they're kind of equating this and even raising it above, raising Hitler's words above that of your typical religious institutions and religious beliefs. So there are different ways that this charismatization of Hitler is really happening in Nazi Germany, whether that's through himself or whether that's through the way people are portraying him. And so that is something that is crucial, because one of the things that many people, and as you mentioned, Albert Speer in particular, mention is that it's really this charisma, not only of Hitler himself, but surrounding Hitler, that makes them either join the party, makes them more ardent followers of the party, whatever the case may be. In the case of Albert Speer, and it's important to preface Speer in saying that Speer is kind of an enigma, even to those who interview him, like Gita Sereny. Nobody really knows what's going on under the surface with him. And so it's really hard, perhaps more so with him than with many others, to determine what he's saying is actually true, what is not, and what he truly believes, and to what extent he believes those things. But Speer, as he recollects, at least in his interviews, and Speer, you know, later goes on to become, he is an architect. He helps design kind of what the new layout of Berlin is going to be. So he's very close to Hitler. Hitler kind of personally taps him actually to be the architect of the Nazi party. And he later goes on to become the Minister of Armaments. So he goes pretty high up in the Nazi regime. But at the beginning, as he remembers it in his interviews, he is not a supporter of the Nazis when they are first emerging on the political scene. He thinks they are wild. He thinks they are fanatic. He thinks they are ridiculous. He sees Hitler as kind of this man in an old military uniform who's just kind of very fanatical, kind of insane, spewing all of these ridiculous ideas. And he doesn't get it. He doesn't get why people like him, why people are following him, why people are joining the party. And so he really kind of wants to keep his distance. But he's at the time, I believe he's actually teaching at a university, and his students convince him to go to a rally that's being held. And he goes to this rally, and he identifies this as being the turning point for him, where he goes, and as you said, you know, obviously there's a crowd, there's a reaction to Hitler's speeches, but what really stands out to him, and he talks a great deal about this, is that it was Hitler's appearance and his persona that made him start to reconsider, because Hitler didn't show up to that rally in his military uniform. He showed up in a very nice suit. I believe he actually says that it was a blue suit. So he shows up in a suit. He's very composed. He's very collected. And although he's speaking very passionately and ardently, it doesn't have the same fanaticism that Speer kind of had heard about or had come to identify with Hitler. And so he kind of starts to lean more towards Hitler. And again, I think in part of it was being influenced by the crowd's response to Hitler. And he kind of remembers leaving that rally in almost a daze of you know, being caught up in the moment, in Hitler's words, in the crowd's responses. And so there is almost this external influence, not only of Hitler, but of the crowd itself, and not necessarily group conformity, but something very close to it, kind of this group mania, like you said with the Beatles, where you have all these other people who are very into what is going on, and you can't help but kind of be influenced by that yourself to a certain extent. So that's really when Speer decides he's going to join the Nazi party, which he does. And he actually remembers the number that he is given. So he remembers the number Nazi that he becomes, and then just moves up the ladder from there. The interesting thing with the charismatization of Hitler is that, and Speer's account reflects this, that one of the strengths that Hitler had was his ability to adapt and be charismatic to his audience. So in some cases, yes, he was the fanatical, insane person spewing all of these ideas in his military uniform, kind of the idea we get when we see all these pictures or see videos of his speeches. But he could also be the very composed, almost college professor-like individual who could speak more reasonably and could dress in a formal suit. He was the person who could appeal to farmers, who could appeal to businessmen. He was able, and I believe it's Speer actually who recognizes this. He says that Hitler was able, he was kind of like a chameleon in a way. He was able to recognize his audience, what his audience supported or what would appeal to them, and what they wanted to hear. So he knew, like, who wanted to hear his anti-Semitic rampagings. He knew who wanted to hear that the Nazis were going to save Germany from its economic troubles. So he knew and could adjust his presentation to suit those needs. And that was one of the things that really appealed to a lot of people and brought people like Speer into the ranks.
You said that, you know, he was impressed that Hitler wasn't fanatical or something like that.
Yeah.
You know, that the crowds were fanatical, but Hitler wasn't fanatical. Mm-hmm. But Hitler manipulated those crowds into being fanatical. And yes, not just fanatical, but into committing genocide. Mm-hmm. So the fact that he could do it with grace, you know, that's not really that appealing of a quality. I mean, it's kind of a disgusting quality, really, that he could, yes, do it, you know. Okay, I'm going to cut this from the recording, but that charismatization question was a f-ing good question. Okay. Anyway. all right, next question. All right, this is kind of a tangent, but it's a purposeful tangent by the party, and it's an important one. And that is that a major goal of the SS, I believe that's true to say that, was dedicated to finding places and objects that could prove the genetic and, quote, the genetic and geographic roots of Aryans. And the two major examples you give are Atlantis and the Holy Grail. And the entire Indiana Jones movie series is based on this. It is. I'm pretty sure it is.
Yes, it is.
where Indiana Jones is in a race against the Nazis in all three movies, I think, to get these major religious items before the Nazis can get them. And the third one is precisely a race to get the Holy Grail so the Nazis don't get it and use it for, you know, bad stuff. So as you say in the paper, quote, the Aryan race was believed to be descended from the deities who once lived in Atlantis. So, you know, Atlantis is a complete fiction. The Holy Grail, you know, maybe not the physical object, but the powers of it are a complete fiction. And, you know, obviously they never succeeded in finding these things. But the very pursuit created a legitimacy of the party. And I, there has to be some kind of element of, you know, people thinking, well, surely they wouldn't waste that much time and that much energy if it's completely stupid. So therefore, it can't be completely stupid. And the Holy Grail in particular was pursued not just as justification of beliefs, but also as a weapon, because it says that the Holy Grail attracts the light, or something like it attracts the light, and therefore, conversely, it could potentially be a weapon to, quote, repel the darkness of those not worthy of living. And so here's an extended quote, and then I'm just going to ask you to just elaborate on this. Quote, if the SS found the Holy Grail, it would have appeared as though God himself had guided the Nazis to its location, thus implying that the Nazis had approval of heaven. This, in turn, would have been depicted by the actions of the Nazis, including the genocide they initiated, as being morally correct and aligned with the desires of God. That's kind of messed up. That first sentence is kind of messed up. That if they found it, then it's only because God himself found it. So it's like, if I find something, it's only because God told me to find it. It's not just that I happened to stumble on it, or I happened to, you know, use my logic to find it or whatever. That if I find something, it's only because God said that I was supposed to find it. It's a very weird, you know, I can't even put my head around that, really. But it's basically, if I'm successful, it's only because God said that I would be successful, not because I did something.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, they very much believe that if they find the Holy Grail, or if they find Atlantis, or whatever the case may be, that it is predestined. That because no one else has been able to find these things, that somehow if they find it, then God intended for them to find it. So it's a massive thing to try to wrap your head around. And Himmler is really going to be the person who's pushing this. There are other paganists and occultists who believe in the existence of Atlantis, who believe that the Holy Grail is something that can and should be found, and who promote these ideas. But Himmler is going to be the person who kind of latches onto them and spins them to then become something that his SS is now going to focus some of their attentions on. And like I said, there's an entire division that their sole purpose is just to find Atlantis, to find the Holy Grail. And so they go on expeditions throughout the world looking for these things. And part of it, as you already mentioned, is because the Holy Grail, obviously it has its Christian connotations as being the chalice that held Christ's blood after his crucifixion, that it was used in the Last Supper. But there's also pagan traditions that go along with it, saying, as you said, that it's a source of light, that it could repel the darkness, so to speak, of anybody who was considered to be unholy. So again, going back to this idea of Lebens und Vertes Leben, and that possessing this grail would not only somehow justify the SS and justify the Nazis as being correct in what they're doing because God has allowed them to find it, or they now have this object that is believed to be a source of light, that somehow it would make them seem like they were morally justified and morally rational in what they were doing, but also that they could then use it as a weapon to expel from the Volksgemeinschaft anybody who they felt was not worthy of life, or was not worthy to be a part of the Volksgemeinschaft. And Atlantis kind of is in conjunction with that, this idea that if you find Atlantis, again, a fictional place, that it is believed through paganist and mythological teachings that it is the birthplace of the gods, that it is where the gods and the deities lived, which, again, going back, they think that Aryans are people who are descended from these deities themselves. So this belief that if you can find Atlantis, then you can somehow prove that the Aryan race is in fact a race, that they are in fact descended from the deities, and therefore that the Nazis, by extension, are somehow backed by the deities and have this innate divine power kind of coursing through them. Obviously, they never find either. So their searches are totally they never come to fruition. But it does demonstrate how important not only these objects, but also locations were to the Nazis, because on the one hand, they are justifying Nazi racial theories, Nazi racial practices and pogroms. But on the other, it serves as an opportunity for the Nazis to really validate their regime's authority and promote the movement as kind of an innovative religious denomination, their own pseudo-religion that has roots in both Christianity and paganism, and further verifies, you know, their belief system.
It would elevate their pseudo-religion to actual religion.
Mm-hmm. It would, yeah. Indeed, yeah. And I think that was Himmler's goal. Himmler viewed the SS as modern crusaders. He felt that this was a new religious war, that he actually viewed the Holocaust and even certain elements of World War II, you can argue to a certain extent. He viewed it not as a genocide necessarily, but as a religious war that the Nazis were waging against those they determined unworthy of life. And he felt that the SS had been tapped as a specific, unique group to serve as crusaders, to be kind of the head of this fight against various groups, but most namely Jews. So yeah, Himmler definitely wanted to construct everything into kind of this religious component. And once he goes to paganism, once he converts to paganism, I use convert very loosely, but I don't have another good term for it. He really takes the SS in that direction.
What was his position in the SS?
He was the head of the SS. It was kind of his brainchild in a way. You have the black shirts that are created and they serve almost as, I want to say almost as the protectorate of Hitler. They are kind of the very special, very elite ground forces that do eventually become responsible for Einsatzgruppen and killings, for being in charge of death camps. So they're really, if you had to pinpoint one group that is predominantly responsible for the Holocaust, it is the SS. And Himmler is the person who is in charge of the entire SS. He's placed in as the head of it. And therefore, obviously, has ranks up there with people like Goebbels and Goering. He's up there.
Okay. Okay. All right. So the last two questions are really connecting our two interests. As I said, when I first discovered that you were writing this paper, I immediately started thinking of connections, similarities, or whatever you call it, parallels between our two subjects. So mm-hmm. These last two questions really connect those two things. So, mainstream economics is, like religion in Nazi Germany, mainstream economics is a tool to justify, it's a tool to justify genocide. It's a tool to justify austerity. It's not as blatant and direct and immediate. It's much slower paced and less direct, but it kind of is. Mainstream economics is used to justify suffering, is used to justify depriving people of what they're desperately needing. And this is especially true, with our ecological crisis that we're currently facing and is going to be getting much more intense over the next decades. And that's the parallel I really want to draw with this interview. And mainstream economics really is a religion. And your university's president, Harvard's president, is one of its leading figures, Larry Summers. Mm-hmm. So, you know, you did some reading on MMT. So I wanted to get, you know, obviously you can only understand so much just with a little bit of reading, but to get your feeling of this parallel of if, you know, obviously I can answer questions if you have a question about MMT itself, but do you see any parallels, or what parallels do you see between your subject of religion being used, you know, false religion being used to manipulate the populace, and from my side, false economics being used to manipulate the populace to serve those on top?
And based upon what I read, and feel free to correct me if I'm wrong, but when I was reading about MMT, the idea that there is this sense of false economics, that, you know, we're not on the gold standard anymore, and governments, especially our government in particular, we create money and have the ability to use money and resource money kind of as we see fit. And the fact that funds can be appropriated for things that Congress wants to find funding for, but cannot, or is not, I should say, is not necessarily used for other things that perhaps it should be used for, such as reducing poverty or providing universal health care, that it really is a reflection of manipulation by people in power, because that funding is sometimes spent elsewhere in things that are perhaps in certain respects not as important to be resolving at that moment in time. And one of the examples that I believe was used in by Stephanie Kelton in the book was talking about the space race and the fact that you had severe economic crises that were happening. You had poverty. Of course, we have the Vietnam War that's still happening at the time. There are significant issues with healthcare. There were still, even at that time, you know, environmental issues that had to be addressed. And Congress is appropriating an intense amount of money. In some cases, you know, especially as the race is kind of ramping up, so pre-Apollo 11, after we've landed on the moon and everyone sees subsequent missions as being totally just wasteful and insignificant and not important. But prior to that, there's this backing driven largely by Kennedy that Congress should appropriate funds, pretty much as much funding as is needed, to NASA to fund the Apollo program and the moon landing. But there is reluctance then, and there is reluctance even still now, to appropriate funding for things like providing financial relief for people who need it. And we see that with the pandemic of, you know, there's this lashback and this pushback and this hesitance from Congress to continue paying stimulus checks or to continue providing financial assistance to small businesses. So it's really a choice of what the people in power feel is important and where they want to appropriate funds, and also what their goals are. So these decisions and the goals of the people in power and the myths to a certain extent that are created or are perpetuated, or just even the sheer indifference to issues that do need to be addressed, are kind of mirrored to a certain extent by the things that I've seen in my own research and that we have discussed to a certain extent today, that I discuss in my paper. This idea that regardless of whether or not the decisions are right or wrong, the people in power really do have the control to make those decisions, and that the decisions they make, the false discourses that they create, filter down into society. They not only affect those who, for instance, with the Third Reich, obviously anti-Semitic discourse is negatively affecting Jews, but those ideas are filtering down to those below them, to kind of the general populace, and feeding things, whether it's feeding beliefs that other people have, whether it's feeding the perpetuation of economic issues. If we look at the case of poverty and how, you know, the refusal to do things like appropriate funding or to better resource or more responsibly resource funds to areas that in which it's needed perpetuates issues and can even heighten them.
So, I mean, that really wasn't too bad. I have a couple of comments, which I'll say in a minute, but that was pretty solid given how, you know, how little familiarity you have with it. So I'm going to ask again. So can you connect that of the Nazis party false religion and as an effort to for those on top to just do whatever the hell they wanted, and with MMT and how that reveals that mainstream economics in my view is basically the same thing. It's the excuse to say that, to hide the fact that they want to do something behind we must do something.
Mm-hmm.
It's that depriving the poor, that staying rich, that lavishing ourselves and depriving everybody else is unfortunate but necessary. We don't want to do it, but we have to.
Mm-hmm. Yes, definitely. One of the things that stood out to me in the book, in Kelton's book, in The Deficit Myth, there was a quote, and I forget which politician it was, but he basically openly said, like, his first goal was not to address. He was speaking on behalf of the Republicans, but he was saying, you know, their goal was not to necessarily address poverty. It was not to address healthcare. He did not list any of those as being their primary goal. His only goal, he said, was to make sure that Obama remained a one-term president. Uh-huh. And so I think that is really powerful in showing that whether it's partisanship, whether it's just what certain political parties, different groups, different committees, different individuals, if they are in power, what they view as being important, whether it is because that is genuinely what they think is important and needs to be addressed, or whether it's because they're trying to serve their own purposes and their own goals, that they make decisions that then affect those who are not in power, such as not providing, you know, or causing a great deal of difficulty in providing funds for people who were struggling and were in poverty, especially during the recession in 2008 and beyond. So the fact that you had politicians who were less concerned about alleviating economic suffering of average Americans, that instead their primary focus was just solely partisan based and was solely based on trying to, in a way, undermine their president, it shows that the people in power can manipulate economics to do whatever, like you said, whatever they want to do, whatever they think is important, whatever suits them and serves their needs, just like we see the Nazis doing the same thing in the 1930s and in the first half of the 1940s, where they are manipulating religion, existing religion, and they are creating their own pseudo-religion that is justifying their crimes of genocide, that is depicting them as this upright, divinely ordained political party and movement, because in a way they're both, to then perpetuate their ideas, to rationalize their ideas, and to spread their ideas to fulfill the goals that they want to do. So in both cases, you can see these leaders, political leaders, doing and making decisions that are really suiting their self-interest, even at the cost and the detriment to those they're supposed to be serving.
We're not killing 11 million people because we want to. We're killing 11 million people because God says we have to.
Yes.
Okay. Yeah, that's good. Okay. So, all right, before the final question, I just want to say one thing regarding what you said about MMT, which was generally correct. You basically, as everybody does, you basically said, you know, if they want to find the funding to do what they want to do, then they can. I would actually say that although there technically is funding, you know, there actually is money and funding, and you know, that's the mechanics. And there's a lot of stupid stuff created to specifically make those mechanics feel much more than they are. I would actually really strongly suggest that there's only in the federal context, of course. I'm not talking state or local. In the federal context, I would actually strongly suggest that you just completely excise the idea that there is a concept of funding at all. Meaning, what I mean by that is federal representatives, national representatives, don't have to find funding. There's no such thing as finding funding. If they decide to do something, that is funding. If they decide to give a fossil fuel companies, huge, whatever you call them, huge just subsidies, then if they vote to do that, that creates the funding. Therefore, the funding itself is nothing more than a manifestation of their decisions. And you really shouldn't even consider them as separate. The funding is their decision. They don't have to find the funding. Their decision is the funding. So this idea that there is money in the national context, although again, there technically is, that conceptually it's much more accurate and insightful that there really is, there is no such thing as separating funding from their decision. They're the same exact thing. And for me, I think that makes it a lot easier to understand. So it's not that they can't find the funding to give everybody healthcare. They're just choosing not to give everybody healthcare. Because if they chose to give everybody healthcare, that would create the funding for it. So that's my one comment, but that's kind of an important concept, that there is no separation between their decision and the funding in the national context. So, okay, final question. And again, this is another aspect of how our two subjects connect or how they're parallel as I see it. If the New Deal were implemented in the late 1800s, then World War I and the rise of Hitler and the Nazi Party would have never happened. And this was told to me by two PhD economists. One, his name is Dirk Entz, and he wrote a book. I might have the title a little bit off, but I'll link it in the show notes. MMT and the European Monetary Union. And there's another PhD economist, Asad Zaman, who in a lecture, which I'll link in the show notes, he also says this. If the New Deal happened in the 1800s, World War I and Hitler would have never happened to begin with. He just would have never risen to power. And this is, there's a book by Karl Polanyi called The Great Transformation. It is an unbelievable book, just unbelievable. 1942, 2001 edition, though, is the one I recommend. Is that he says that there is no such thing as fascism as a movement unto itself. Fascism is not a movement unto itself. There is no strength in fascism or fascists. Rather, that fascism only exists to fill the vacuum left by the suffering of neoliberalism and, you know, more generally, just exploitation by the rich. So it's not that Hitler and the Nazi Party were powerful. It's that the German people were so terribly neglected that there was nothing else for them to grasp onto. And so the hatred by regular Germans of Jewish people and other, you know, unworthy, whatever. I see it, you know, it was suggested in your paper by someone in your paper that Germans always hated Jews. It was always inside of them. And this just allowed them to unleash it. I don't think that's true. I see it as that their hatred of the Jews is not because they genuinely hated the Jews. I mean, I'm sure some did, but whatever. Overall, I think it's because they were deceived into thinking that all of society's ills are primarily caused by those with the least money and power to distract them from those who are really causing the problems, which are those with the most money and most power. They have been neglected for so long that this is just simply the easiest way for them to vent their frustrations in a way that serves power. It's distracting from them punching up so that they don't stand up and protest and whatever, and allows them to vent that frustration on someone that doesn't inconvenience or threaten the power of those on top. So, so I don't think it was a latent, always there hatred of Jews. I think it was just simply that they're so terribly treated that this was just an outlet, just like we have video games and pornography and streaming television shows and whatever. These are just outlets for people to vent the frustration of their exploitation for their entire lives. So that was much more all over the place than I expected, but I would hope that you got something out of that. So I would like to hear what you have to say about
Yes. No, I definitely agree with that. That was Daniel Goldhagen who made that assertion. And that's one of my major critiques of his work, is that I also do not think it was latent anti-Semitism. I think, you know, perhaps for some individuals, perhaps it was. But on the whole, anti-Semitism really spread much more rampantly and became much more virulent in Germany as a result of the fact that, you know, the Nazis were targeting Jews as someone to blame for their economic troubles, and it gave them an outlet. Because you're right, Germans were very, I guess neglected is a good word. It's important to remember that Germany is actually still a new nation at the time of the First World War, relatively new in terms of, you know, modern republics and things like that. Germany is founded as an empire and finally unified in 1871. So they're not unified until quite late in the 19th century. Under Bismarck, they're very militarized because of Prussian influence. And when we get to the First World War, Germans are really brought into the conflict because of their alliance with Austria-Hungary. And at the end of the war, with the Treaty of Versailles, they are then forced to take the entire blame for the war, with the War Guilt Clause, for a war that they did not technically start. They, you know, they lose all their colonies, they lose some of their land actually in Europe itself. Their territory is decreased. They lose the Saarland, which is going to amplify economic issues because the Saarland is a coal-rich region. And so without that coal supply, it's going to hurt them economically. They have their military reduced significantly to 100,000 men in the army, 36 ships in the navy, and no air force. And so you have a loss of jobs that is going along with that. And perhaps most notably, they have to pay $132 billion in reparations to the victors. And so Germany's depression is going to be severe, and it's going to speed up very rapidly after the First World War, to the point where by the end of 1923, a loaf of bread costs 200,000 million marks. And at that point, the German mark completely collapses because it no longer has any value whatsoever and has to be restructured then the following year, with new Reichsmarks being put into circulation. What further is hurting Germany, besides just the fact that they are in a severe depression and people are extremely hurt economically. Germany is humiliated by the Treaty of Versailles in that they not only were reduced territorially, economically, militarily, their national pride is hurt also in a sense because they had to accept responsibility for all of the losses of the war. And in addition to that, you have the Weimar Republic, which is being formed in 1918. So in the same year the war is ending, as the Treaty of Versailles is being constructed, which Germany is technically not even invited to the peace talks. They are not really given a choice over signing the treaty. They're basically handed the treaty and forced to sign. And so you have many Germans who associate this humiliating treaty, this terrible economic condition in which they find themselves after the war, and they link it with this new Weimar Republic and the government of the Weimar Republic that came into power at the very end of the war. And there's actually a theory that circulates in Germany. It's called the stab in the back theory. This belief that these new Weimar Republic government officials that they stabbed Germans in the back by not only signing the surrender, but then signing the Treaty of Versailles that they think ultimately destroyed Germany and everything Germany was prior to World War I. And so the Nazis including Hitler, really feed off of all of that. They feed off of the stab in the back theory, which creates increasing distrust in the government of the Republic and undermines their authority, undermines what they're doing. It also, they also feed off of the fact that there is this economic crisis that they're pledging to fix if they are brought into power. And everything, they really just rest on the fact that Germany is not what it once was. Germany is weak. Germany is humiliated. Germany is not Germany anymore. And it's because of this republic, and it's because of the economic crises. And they, the Nazis basically come in saying, you know, we understand this. We hear your complaints. We see your issues, and we're going to fix it. And that's what people want to hear. The Nazis also give them a scapegoat and say, well, all of your sufferings are because of the Weimar Republic and the government of the Weimar Republic. All of your sufferings are because of Jews. And so it gives people someone to blame and increases some of that exclusionary discourse and distrust in the government that ultimately culminates in the Nazis gaining more seats, Hitler being appointed chancellor as a way to kind of appease him, and then ultimately the Nazis rising to power and Hitler consolidating everything into the role of Führer after Hindenburg dies.
Just a very brief comment on the hyperinflation of Weimar. Yeah, it's technically accurate to say that the Reichmark lost, had no value. I mean, that's technically accurate to say, but it's a much, much more important to say that there was nothing to have value.
Yes.
There was nothing in the country to have value. And that was a much larger problem than the fact that the Reichmark happened to have no value. So, the Treaty of Versailles, something else I learned from Polanyi, is the Treaty of Versailles said that said that Germany was never allowed to militarize again, and that that was a major contributor to World War II.
Yes,
because if you're not allowed to empower yourself, then you're clearly not going to be equal to those who are powerful. And in the belligerent world that we live in, that's a problem. And you know there's no such thing as equality except between equals. And so if these major powers that are on the other side of that Versailles Treaty are powerful and are militarized, and then now Germany is not, you know, that's just brewing trouble.
Yes.
Yeah, that was it.
Yeah.
Okay, that was a lot. Is there anything that's – I'm done. Is there anything that you want to say before we stop?
I think it's just really interesting to see parallels in how politics, how economics, how religion, all of these things can truly intersect throughout history and can be manipulated and used in ways that – suit the needs of people in power and hurt those who are considered beneath them, who are considered excluded parts of society. And I think it's something that bears remembering. It's something that bears studying, because Mark Twain has a fantastic quote that says history doesn't repeat itself, but it does rhyme. So, you know, there are always new situations that come up in the world, and we can see some even today where you see reflections of things happening that are not identical to you, and it's very crucial to note that, but that bear similarities to things that we saw happening with the rise of the Nazis in Germany in the early 1930s. We can see things like that happening throughout the world today. We can see similarities to German expansion throughout much of Europe. And it's important to just keep these things from the past in mind as we move forward, because if we really don't learn from the past, then we'll end up repeating a lot of the same mistakes. And so I think it's important to recognize these patterns and to recognize what did happen in the hopes of preventing, you know, in the extreme case, another genocide, but to also just prevent other injuries to people from happening in the future. because there's another great quote from Ian Kershaw, who's a historian, who said that the road to Auschwitz was built by hate but paved with indifference. And so I think that closely ties in that nobody can really be indifferent to what's happening in the world, and we just need to learn from the past to take action and prevent it.
Cool. All right. Well, thank you for doing this. All, you know, this was obviously more than we scheduled. It's really hard to estimate, you know, the right question list to, you know, ensure that it's going to fit within the scheduled time. So thank you very much for being flexible, and you know, thanks for a really, really interesting paper. It was really cool.
Thank you. And thank you for having me. I enjoyed talking about it. So.
Cool. All right. This was great. I've been waiting a long time. I'm glad we finally got to do it.
Yes, me too.
All right. See you later.
All right. See you.
Music for this show is by Rec Tech. You can find Rec Tech on SoundCloud and Spotify at WRECK_TECH. To record Activist MMT, I use the iOS phone app Tape a Call Plus for recording phone calls and Zencaster for internet-based recordings. My post-production workflow starts by editing on the iOS app AnyTune Pro Plus, then transferring those timestamps to my Windows desktop. At that point, I crudely process the audio in Audacity and then implement the edits and do all of the final processing in the Reaper Digital Audio Workstation. Activist MMT is hosted by Libsyn, and the video teasers are created with the online Headliner app.
Today's the final part of a three-part conversation with historian, author, and Harvard Master's graduate Emily Rule on her new paper and master's thesis, In League with the Divine, How Religion Influenced Nazi Perpetrators of the Holocaust. You will find my detailed question list at the bottom of the show notes for part one, and also be sure to see the list of audio chapters in all three parts to find exactly where each topic is discussed. A full introduction can be found at the beginning of part one. But for now, let's get right back to my conversation with Emily Rule. Enjoy.